Valley for a long time. And very respected in our movement. She's a wonderful lecturer. She's famous all over the free world for her lecture.
Are you going to start telling the truth here?
I generally don't. I may be hitting very close right now. The floor is all yours.
The floor is mine. That's a nice floor. Okay, I should have already turned this on. I'm doing an experiment to see if I can travel without books. And I used to travel with a printer. So this is my first time having my notes on one of these gizmos.
Is that like a Kindle? Is that what that
is? It's like a Kindle.
Is it teeny tiny?
Little Kindle.
Yeah, I can read it. Yeah, my son Keshava just spent hours and hours setting it up.
Put Prabhupada's
Narada, where are you going, son?
Put Prabhupada's books on it. And
you can get all Srila Prabhupada's books on it. Huh?
Specifically, I wrote a program that you can convert any of Prabhupada's books to read on there.
PDFs?
Yeah.
June 19, 2010, San Diego.
I'm
glad to know you.
I have your number on your way out.
Well, he's hoping that the work he did... I'm just thinking I want to sit someplace.
You want to sit up here?
No, but I'd like to sit where I can see everybody. Okay. So I'm going to take all my stuff. Okay. There we go.
You need a cushion?
Yeah, I don't need a cushion. Yeah. I'm sure. That's fine. What?
You took care of your bones.
You took care of my bones, I guess, huh? So it's nice to be here. So you just asked me to talk about association with devotees. So is that all right?
Yeah.
But should we do that? I mean, like, we could do a different topic.
Sounds good.
So I was thinking about why we want to have community in general. Why do human beings want to have a community? For having friends that are both have similar interests to ours and also add some individual flavor to what we're doing. I mean, we don't want to be with people who are exactly like us. But yeah, we want to have people that share our interests. And I was also thinking about that as a soul, we're originally from Goloka Vrindavan, Vaikuntha, which is a community. One of the nice things about the philosophy that Srila Prabhupada taught us is that the ultimate reality is personal. That in the spiritual world, there's homes, there's families, there's activities, there's community. People are doing things together. And there's different groups. People have their family groups and their friendship groups. And we're trying to imitate that in this world. You know, in our eternal home, we have an eternal family. Although there's no birth, death, old age, and disease there, still we have people that we consider our mother and father, our brothers and sisters, our aunts and uncles. There's a book written by Rupa Goswami where he details all these family trees of Goloka Vrindavan. You know, who's Nanda Maharaj's brothers and who's their wives, his brother's wives, and who's their children and who's cousins and who's aunts and who's uncles. So that's our original position, is to be part of a family, to be part of a community. As explained in the spiritual world, that the members of the village of Vrindavan gather every evening for entertainment. Of course, everyone's looking at Krishna rather than the entertainers. You know, but there's singers and acrobats and jugglers. And people come together, and they come together for eating. Right? There's descriptions of the meals, Krishna eating with his family. So this is our natural hankering. As a soul, of course, sometimes we get disgusted with other people and with community. Sometimes we're just like, I'm not going to deal with anybody anymore, you know, just go off to the mountains or something like that. But then we begin to have a community with the squirrels and the trees. And generally, eventually, we come back to humans. I remember when I was 16, I was on a youth bicycle trip through the Jasper Banff National Park in Western Canada. any of you have been there, it's really beautiful. We were bicycling up and down the Rocky Mountains, and at one point we came to Lake Louise, which is a lake that's formed by a melting glacier. And it's pristine, you know, clear water. You can drink the water there, at least you could way back when I was 16. And I remember that we took a boat to a little island in the lake, and I was sitting there thinking, wow, I could just stay here the rest of my life. And then I realized, no, I really couldn't. I'd miss people. I'd miss community. It would be very difficult just to stay here by myself. And that experience I had sitting on the island for a few hours really helped me to decide that I wanted to dedicate my life to Krishna consciousness. Because when I heard the personal philosophy, I said yes. I had been looking for spirituality, but I was looking for it in an impersonal way. I wanted to lose my identity and merge into the absolute. And after sitting on this lake, on the island in the lake, I thought, no, that's not what I really want to do. I really want to be part of a community. So I thought we'd look at a few things. I thought we'd look at the power of association and general principles given in the scriptures in the Shastra about how to associate with different people. And then what are the problems with having close association with people who are not devotees of Krishna? Why are there such strong warnings in the scripture about that? And the benefits of associating with devotees, then how to associate with devotees, and then a little discussion of the people in our lives who aren't devotees of Krishna. So I thought we'd think about how we're affected by the other people in our lives. And you especially see with raising children that the children develop according to what you approve of and disapprove of, especially when they're very, very small. And it's often communicated very subtly. If the child does something that you like, you smile, you laugh, you nod. And if they do something you don't like, you're more reserved. But my point is that it's very, very subtle. The communication of the norms of a particular culture is done in a very, very subtle way by the responses of the people around you. And a lot of the effect of our association on us is that we naturally try to please the people around us. We want them to like us. Nobody wants to be thought of as a fool or as odd, right? As someone who doesn't know the rules. Are you guys going?
We'll be right back.
Yeah, sometimes when you're in an unusual environment or a strange environment with people you don't know, especially in a foreign country, or you travel lots of foreign countries, and sometimes you're not quite sure what are the rules here. What do you do? When Srila Prabhupada first met his spiritual master, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, he tells a story that his guru was sitting on a sofa like this, and Srila Prabhupada came and just sat next to him. And then he saw that all the other disciples coming in the room were sitting on a lower seat. And he thought, oh, I should be sitting at a lower level. I shouldn't be sitting at the same level. And he said, for that meeting, I stayed where I was. But the next time I sat... So we try to adjust ourselves to the norms of the people with whom we associate. Right? We want to dress in a way that's acceptable to them. Right? We were talking, I think it was yesterday, about how one of the main ways you make an impression on people is how you're dressed. You know, are your clothes neat? Do they fit? And then are they in style? Are they acceptable for that situation? The language that you use, the references you make, the things that you know about. Oh, you don't know about that? You've never heard about that? You don't know about this person? Really? So we want to have the same kind of base knowledge as the people around us. The same base knowledge, something where we can fit in. So our association very much affects our behavior. It affects our values. It affects our culture. It affects how we understand the world, how we filter the world, what meaning we ascribe to things. And this is very easy to understand if you look at different cultures. For example, if you look at American culture and Indian culture. So in Indian culture, when you go to someone's house and they feed you, and they say, would you like some more rice? And you say, no, thank you. The way they show respect for you is to put the rice on your plate anyway. And when you first experience that coming from America, you think, why don't they have any respect for me? Why are they treating me with such disrespect? Right? But it works the other way too. You know, if you have some people from India over to your house and you say, would you like some more rice? And they say, no, thank you. And so you think, oh, I'll respect their wishes. I won't give them any more rice. They'll be sitting there and thinking, why are they treating me so disrespectfully? Don't they know you're not supposed to ask for things? I read once that in Japan you're supposed to say no at least 4 times. Would you like some more? No. Please have some more. No, that's okay. I'd like to give you some more. No. At least 4 times before you can say, oh, okay, just a little. Right? So in both cultures, people are trying to show respect, but they're showing respect in opposite ways. Therefore, how do you interpret what something means? If somebody gives you rice when you said no, does it mean that they don't respect you? Does it mean that they do respect you? These sort of ways that we interpret the world are also coming from the people with whom we associate. What's good? What's bad? How are you rude? How are you respectful? How are you considerate? How are you responsible? You know, we tend to think that the way we interpret the world is just the way the world is. Well, it's obvious. It's like that. This person was irresponsible. But maybe they had a different interpretation. And that comes to a large extent from the people with whom we associate. How do we understand reality? One of the main teachings of the Shastra is that conditioned souls have 4 defects. Imperfect senses, the tendency to be illusion, to cheat, to make mistakes. So that how we perceive reality, each of us, how we're perceiving reality, is not objective reality. None of us perceive objective reality. Especially when it comes to people's behavior. I mean, we don't even, of course, perceive objective reality when it comes to objects. Like science will tell us that this is made up of mostly space. But that's not how I perceive it. Or, like, for example, the cells in our bodies are constantly changing. But I don't perceive it that way. Well, to speak of human behavior, I mean, we all have examples in our relationships where what I intended to communicate is not what's understood by you. But again, we have groups of people who have general understandings of things, and these change with association. I mean, one of the first things I noticed once I joined the Hare Krishna movement, and when I joined the Hare Krishna movement, joining meant you dropped out of college, you left your family, you brought, you know, one little suitcase and moved into an ashram. You know, I wasn't even sure if I could bring shampoo, kind of thing. That was what joining the Hare Krishna movement meant in those days. It was a real extreme sort of thing. And after I lived in the ashram for maybe a week or two, and I was chanting regularly, I noticed that my view of the world was changing. How I interpreted things was changing. I felt as if I was putting on a pair of glasses. It's like, oh, wow. That's what it means, that I could see things differently. And I know I've had experience that as someone trying to be a devotee, to work out in the world among people who aren't devotees, and how radically different they see the world. Radically different. They see that we're this body. And that life is meant for enjoyment of the body. I have a very different view of reality. We can also think, when we think about association, where Krishna talks about karana guna sangasya, that the cause of all of our happiness and distress in the world is how we're associating with the modes of nature. You know, science... When should I end, by the way, so I can cut a plan? Whenever I like. I was talking about how none of us really see objective reality, and the filter we have over us, according to the Bhagavad Gita, is made of some combination of the modes of nature. So modern scientists are trying to figure out what they call unified field theory. Have you ever heard of that? Mm-hmm. One equation that would describe all of reality. They're looking for something you could put on a t-shirt. And the reason that they haven't been able to do it is explained by Thomas Kuhn in Structure of Scientific Revolution, which is a great book to read, a little dense, but worth the trouble. And something like, see, I don't think you have kind of a pattern on your clothes. Your skirt is really nice. Has kind of a pattern on it. So if I were to look at just one part of your skirt, and then I could describe reality by looking at that one part of your skirt, I wouldn't be describing the whole skirt. It's too complicated. Think of a complicated tapestry. So the way that scientists look at reality is they have some theories that describe certain things in reality, and then there are certain anomalous things that are outside. And the problem is that they're contradictory, that you can't, that theory that's explaining this part of reality, it can't accommodate those things over there. So they like to say, well, that just sort of, they grow in their theory and they start accommodating more and more. But that's not really what's happening. What's really happening is they'll have a theory that describes this part of reality. And then these anomalies, when they become very, how would you say, in your face, sorry for the slang, then they change their paradigm and all of a sudden they're describing this part of reality. Now these things are anomalous. For example, quantum physics and Newtonian physics can't describe the same aspects of reality. They have things that contradict each other. So the scientists have not been able to come up with one theory that describes the whole picture of reality. If they're describing this piece, they're not describing this piece. And if they're describing this piece, they're not describing this piece. So Krishna comes up with one explanation of all of reality. He says that one thing that's constant throughout the material world is the three modes of material nature. He said there's no being existing anywhere in the material world that's not subject to these three modes of material nature. Now, we can't necessarily say that about laws of mathematics. We can't necessarily say that the way time and space operate on this planet are the same way they operate on Alpha Centauri, for example. And Einstein even said that they probably don't operate in the same way. But the modes of material nature are all over the universe. And the way the modes of material nature work is they act as a filter that allow you to interpret reality in a different way. A very simple example of that is what we consider food. So what an anteater considers food, a few weeks ago I went with my grandchildren in Hawaii to the zoo and we saw this anteater. You know, its brain is like, not as big as a pea. You know, it's got this huge body and this tiny little head. And to that anteater, food is ants. But to us, ants are not food. So the modes of material nature are what create the particular kind of body we have according to the mind, as explained in 15th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. So according to our mental state, we get a body that's, basically Krishna says, senses grouped around the mind. And this body and mind that we have developed in the modes of material nature tells us this is desirable, this is not desirable. This is food, this is not food. This is beautiful, this is ugly. And you can see in the different species of life, different creatures will think something is beautiful that we wouldn't think is beautiful. Right? I mean, none of us would think a warthog is beautiful, but the male warthog thinks the female warthog is beautiful. And that's because of a certain filter of the modes of material nature. And then as human beings also, each of our bodies is a different combination of the modes. And each of our mentality is formed from a different combination of the modes. And this, again, we see the world, what's desirable, what's undesirable, what's nice, what's not nice. The mind is accepting and rejecting. Okay, I'm going to accept this. But how do we decide what we want to accept? That is determined by the modes that's covering us. You can think of it that we, the soul, are like white light. And then the modes are like colored filters that are coming over that light. Or if you want to think of the light coming through a window, you know, sunlight coming through a window, and you can have just a wall that doesn't come through at all. You can have translucent glass like a lot of people have in a bathroom window. You can have clear glass. So the mode of ignorance is just like a wall, no light's coming through. And when you're covered by the modes of ignorance, what you think you're perceiving is reality has almost nothing to do with actual reality. How you're perceiving reality and what reality is are almost completely disconnected. In the mode of passion, which is like translucent glass, you're seeing things somewhat. Or sometimes you sort of see things the way they are. And if with goodness, when the glass is clear, you actually see things where they are. Therefore, Krishna says in goodness, all the gates of the body are illumined by knowledge. You actually see things as they are. You hear things as they are. You're in touch with truth. The mode of goodness is also called in Sanskrit sattva.
So how does one acquire or get these filters?
What causes different people to get different filters to see the reality to be different?
Many things. What I'm going to look at tonight is what people we choose to associate with.
Oh.
So many things. What filters you have depends upon what mood you have when you give any kind of charity. And that doesn't just mean money. That means time, expertise, anything that you give. What's your mood in giving? What kind of food that you eat? What kind of determination you have? But we'll look at specifically what sort of people you have as your intimate associates. Because as I said, the people with whom you intimately associate are the people who shape what you feel is acceptable and what is not acceptable, and shape your view of the world. So if you associate with people, with other people who are like a wall, then your view of reality starts to also be like a wall. We tend to, this is a nice quote I wanted to read, association is like a crystal stone which will reflect anything which is put before it.
May I ask?
Sure.
So the choices we make in terms of, say, associating with people depend on how we have been exposed to so far.
Yes.
Some people like to associate with good people, and some people get attracted with different associations.
Yes.
So how do we
change it?
Yeah.
You make a you have to make a determination. How do you change anything in your life? You look at what you're doing and say, this isn't working for me.
So you have to...
You have to make a conscious choice.
Okay.
I mean, I think of, as a general analogy, I think of the modes of material nature as something like being in a bookstore or a multiplex movie theater. Well, let's say a bookstore. There's the travel books, there's the cookbooks, the philosophy books, the horror books, the romance books. And you go to a different part of the bookstore. You decide, I want to read the philosophy books, or I want to read the horror novels, or I want to read the romance books, or whatever. And then when you're in a certain section of that shop, you pick up a book and you start reading it. Now, once you start reading the book, you become absorbed in the book. The book becomes your reality. But you do have a choice to put down a book even in the middle and go to a different part of the bookstore. Now, one of the problems that each of us have is that because of our choices in the past, we have now a particular body and a particular mentality that's our own unique combination of the three modes of material nature. Just like paint, you have three colors, you mix them together, and then you get nine. Then you take nine, you mix them again with those same nine, you get 81, and then you have the original three, so 84. So there's 8,400,000 species of life, and each one is a general combination of the three modes. Then each of our individual bodies, which is why, by the way, each of us look different. We each look different because each of us have our particular combination of the modes of nature that we have in this body. So the modes that we've already cultivated in the past predispose us to be in the same groove. So if we want to change the mode of nature that we're in, we have to make a conscious effort. If we just kind of go on, if you already tend to be in the mode of goodness, then that's all right. But if your tendency is to be in the modes of passion or ignorance or some mix of them, and most of us don't have a tendency to be in pure goodness, then you need to make a conscious choice. And it's difficult. When you've gone on a path for a long time, like you go on a path through a woods for a long time, it's easy. if you want to take a new path, you've got to bring a machete with you. And we've all found that changing our habits or changing our association is awkward at first. And especially if you're going to change the people with whom you associate, like those of us who didn't grow up in the Hare Krishna movement and we decided, okay, I really want to become spiritual. I really want to realize God. I really want something more than material life presents. And you start associating with the devotees. At first, it's very awkward. You're learning a whole new way of seeing the world and whole new norms of behavior and new vocabulary and new everything. It's something like going to a foreign country. And it's definitely difficult. to make that kind of adjustment. But it's definitely a conscious choice. So there are many, many factors that determine to what extent we're seeing things as they are. Now, this is a little side, but why would we want to see things as they are? Why would we care?
You're not happy with the way you are.
Well, that would be a first. But why in general might it be a good idea to see things as they are?
Well, if you're walking through a room in the dark, you run into the furniture.
I love that. That's great. If you're walking through a room in the dark, you run into the furniture. So most of us in life don't have exactly the life that we want. I haven't met someone who said, yes, perfect. And generally what we try to do in the world is we try to find a way to negotiate the room in the dark. So another solution is to turn on the light, to see things as they are. Right? If I'm going to make decisions in management, my degrees are in management, educational management. So the first thing in any decision is information. How can you make a good decision unless you have good information? Just like we just got this e-reader. So first, Keshava and I, we're doing all this research. Right? You made a little table. Here's all the e-readers. It's the size, the weight, memory, what they cost, what they can do, what they can't do. How are you going to get what you want if you don't have any information? So information means truth. What good does it do to have bad information? That's worse than having no information. So if our perception of reality is not what reality is, how can I make good decisions? I can't. Therefore, get out of darkness, come to the light. Come to the light. And the word sattva for the mode of goodness means two things. It means goodness, and it also means, actually three things. It means truth, and it means existence. As Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, anything that really exists, it's eternal. It's always true. So when you come to goodness, when you have the clear glass, you can see things as they are. And one of the ways to do that is to choose for one's close friends, the people that are really influencing us in our life, the people that we're really trying to please, the people that we're trying to become like them, to get along with them, to be part of their society, and part of their community, people who see truth. And the closer that the people that with whom we associate see the truth, as we also become like them, then there's at least a good chance that we'll see the truth. And if the people with whom we associate are in darkness, then it's very difficult for us to come to the truth. If we do come to the truth, we almost won't make any sense to them. You know, our perception of things will be so radically different from theirs that it's difficult to have a common ground. I wanted to look at first about general principles of associating with anybody. And this is a very nice quote from the Srimad Bhagavatam. This was spoken by Narada Muni to Prahlad. We have the little boys Narada and Prahlad. This was spoken by Narada to Prahlad. And here he's talking about how to deal with people in general. He says, every person should act like this. When he meets a person more qualified than himself, he should be very pleased. So often when we meet someone more qualified than ourselves, we become envious. We become critical. We find a way to think of Arkisha, nice to see you. We become some way to think of how they're not really so much better than we are. Well, they're better than I am in this way, but, you know, what about this one? When he meets someone less qualified than himself, he should be compassionate towards him. So often when we meet someone less qualified, we try to take advantage of them. So more qualified, we try to tear them down. Less qualified, we try to take advantage. And here he said we should be pleased when meeting somebody more qualified. Someone less qualified should be compassionate. And when he meets someone equal to himself, should make friendship with them. In this way, one is never affected by the threefold miseries of the material world. You read that and you think, what's the connection? How is it that if I feel happy when people are more qualified than I am, I'm friends with people who have equal qualification, and I'm kind to people with less qualification, that I wouldn't suffer anymore? read something from the purport. Generally, when we find someone more qualified than ourselves, we become envious. When we find someone less qualified, we deride him. When we find someone equal, we become very proud of our own activities. These are the causes of all material tribulations. The great sage Narada therefore advised that a devotee should act perfectly. Instead of being envious of a more qualified person, one should be jolly to receive him. Instead of being oppressive to a less qualified man, one should be compassionate toward him, just to raise him to the proper standard. And when one meets an equal, instead of being proud of one's own activities before him, one should treat him as a friend. One should also have compassion for the people in general who are suffering due to forgetfulness of Krishna. These important functions will make one happy within this material world. So why happy? And then we go to the fact that all of our suffering is due to not seeing things as they are. Because one aspect of the truth, Brahmano hi pratistaham amritasya vyasya shasvatasya tadharmasya sukasya ikantikasya. The absolute truth is full of happiness. All of us desire, one of our main motivations, one main reason we do anything is to be happy. What's true is something that brings happiness. That's one of the main aspects of the truth. So when you see the truth, when your perception of reality is the same as reality, one of the things that you experience is happiness. And according to Srila Prabhupada's guru, Bhaktisiddhanta, although the soul is very tiny, it has a capacity for unlimited happiness. Anandam Buddhivardhanam. That's Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati's comment on that part of the Shikshastika. So falsity is seeing a separation between myself and the truth. And part of this falsity is envy. Thinking that, you know, we're in competition for the resources of the world, we're in competition for the accolades of the world, we're in competition for respect, we're in competition for appreciation, and therefore I have to posit myself as being superior to you. That's part of the illusion of falsity. The reality is that Om Purnamada Purnamidan Purna Purnamudachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnam Eva Vasishchate, that the absolute truth is complete and everything created is also complete. That means I'm complete. That means I already have everything I need right here, right now. I don't need anything. Therefore, I don't need to compete with you for anything. I don't need to prove I'm better than you, ever. And I'm not anyway. We're really all the same. There's nobody really any higher or lower. But wait a minute, I was just talking about higher or lower. Higher or lower means in terms of how clear your glass is. That's what we mean by higher or lower. Are you in a room with just a wall? Are you in a room with a translucent window? Or are you in a room with a clear window? So how clear your... how clearly you can see the sun. That in that way, higher or lower. But the person within the room, or the living entity within the room, are all equal. They're all equal. Just because you're in a dark room without any windows doesn't mean you don't have any eyes. They're just not functioning. So we don't see I'm better than you or I'm worse than anybody. Seeing I'm worse than others is another kind of illusion. We're all equal. And I already have everything I need. Generally, in falsity, one thinks I have to get what I need from you, or I have to take something from you in order to be happy, in order to be satisfied. And as soon as one gives this up, as soon as one deals with others without envy, then one is in truth, and then one has no more miseries. You can say, okay, but when you're in truth, don't you get a hangnail? Or mm-hmm. Don't you feel hungry? But you realize that it's not you. That it's not you. You have a detachment. Just like people can be taught through hypnosis not to experience pain, even when on a so-called practical level there's pain because of detachment. So that's how we should deal with people in general. When we're talking about devotees, non-devotees, or different levels of devotees, it should always be done with the idea that we're equal and there's no envy. There's no need for envy. If one sees the truth, there's no need for envy. And by giving up envy, one comes to the truth. So I want to look at the special benefits, then, of associating with devotees. And we talked about that the people with whom we choose to associate, determine in what modes of nature we're going to operate. But what's especially nice about associating with devotees is it takes you even beyond the modes of nature. It takes you beyond the clear window right to the outside. You know, that you're in the full sunlight of the truth. You're in the full relationship with Krishna. But there's some other examples given of the what's special about associating with devotees. And we can think of, like, with parents and children. If I say to you, oh, Prahlad is so cute, immediately you like me. If I say to you, oh, Lila, you sing so nicely, you may like me, you may not like me. You may think, oh, I'm flattering you. But if I say that Prahlad's cute, you will never think, oh, she's flattering. You'll just like me. If you want to get in someone's good graces, then you have to like, or you give something to, or you spend time with someone who's dear to them. So because those who are devotees of the Lord are very dear to the Lord. In one sense, Krishna says, nobody's dear to me. He said, I'm not anybody's enemy or anybody's friend. But the devotees are acting in a loving relationship with him. And Krishna is neutral. But he's also very reciprocating. Yaya tamam prapadyante. He reciprocates. So if somebody's loving him, that person is very dear to him. Or you could say that someone who's very dependent on him. In one sense, everyone is dependent upon God. Who's not dependent upon God? Right? If I have a stroke right now, I can't move my hand anymore. I'm dependent. I can't control that. Everything that I'm doing, I'm totally dependent on God. But if I feel that way, if I have that mood that, yes, I'm dependent on you, then he feels especially protective of me. Right? Just like we have this my son and his wife have this little baby about 2 months old. So he's so dependent. So naturally, they're very attentive. They're not going to be that attentive when he's 25, I hope. We have to take them in for therapy. So when the devotee has a mood of dependence on Krishna, Krishna is very attentive. And if we associate with such persons with kindness, then Krishna is also specially inclined to us. That's just natural. I had an example of this when I was going to graduate school. So I started out in one program, and the head of the department wanted to bounce me up to the next higher program. And he met with me and he said, you know, okay, I think you should be in the PhD program. And he just pushed it through. He basically changed all the rules. I was taking a bunch of electives that couldn't transfer, and he just said, okay, we'll transfer. And because he said it was okay, and he was the head of the School of Education, the university accepted it. Even though if you looked at the rules, you know, when we were asking, how do we do this? And he said, I don't know. And I went to the secretary, and I said, how do I do this? He said, I don't know. Nobody's ever done this before. I don't know how to do it. He said, just ask Dr. I thought, oh, it's like that. If you get the good graces of the devotee, then Krishna also gives you that good graces. Basically, the administration of the university, they said, oh, the head of the education school said you can do this, then it's okay. Whatever he says, whatever he said became the rule. Just imagine if someone came to this door who's never been here before, but he said, oh, so-and-so, you know, I talked to Yudhisthira. He said, I could come. You say, oh, Yudhisthira said he can. Oh, okay. Right?
Cool.
Even if you haven't met him before. Oh, you know Yudhisthira. He gave you directions. In fact, that's how each of us expands our circle of friends. You know, we start off just trusting our mommy and daddy, and then our brothers and sisters, and we trust, because our mommy and daddy send us to a particular school, we trust those teachers and we trust those people, and we generally get a circle of friends by being introduced to people for whom we already have trust. And so actually God works that way too. He has people he trusts who don't want to cheat him, who don't want to exploit him. And they say to him, hey, you know, this is a nice person. And he said, okay, let him in. Huh? He's also a person. So that's another sign. Not only by associating do we start to mold ourselves according to those people and we start to see things the way they see them, but especially if you associate with devotees, then you get an in. Right? God's a person. He has feelings. And for most of us, at least speaking for myself, how am I going to get in otherwise? I remember once someone saying to me, something's not fair. And I said, you know, if the world were perfectly fair, we'd be in a lot of trouble. I don't want to be judged perfectly fairly by anybody. I don't want any of you judging, you know, really looking at every single thing I've done and every single thing I've said in my life and all my motives and judging me by them, because I wouldn't do very well. I want you to excuse me. I want you to be merciful to me. I want you to be kind to me. I want you to assume I had good intentions even when maybe I only had 10% good intentions. Right? Don't we all feel like that? We want everybody to give us a break. Of course, we don't always give other people a break. We want other people to give us a break. Right? So that mercy. And a lot of the times that we show mercy to somebody, especially if they haven't been too nice to us, is if we're asked by a friend. If some friend comes to us and says, hey, you know, this person, I know you're really mad at them, but they're really sorry, and they'd really like to see you again. And to please your friend, you agreed, okay. So Krishna's also like that. And for many of us, that's our main hope for being back in his association. Another reason to associate with devotees is, it's sort of related, but it's a very interesting understanding of bhakti, or love and devotion for Krishna. And this is explained by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur in his book, Madhurya Kadambini, which, if you haven't read it, I really suggest you read it. In fact, I suggest you read it many times. It's only about this thick, about an eighth of an inch thick. So it's a short read. And it explains the process of spiritual realization from beginning to end. And in the very beginning of that book, he asks a question which I know I asked when I first started practicing Krishna consciousness. Why do some people take up Krishna consciousness and other people don't? People in the same circumstances with the same situation. You know, when you first find out about Krishna consciousness, you think, wow, everybody's going to love this. And you go to your friends and your family and you say, wow, look at this. And some people agree and other people say, I'm not really interested in that. And you, well, why is that? So we know that Krishna's not partial. He makes bhakti available to everyone. So why do some people get it and some people don't? So the answer is given that although Krishna is impartial, he's neutral. He's just as the super soul, as the witness. That his devotees are not always neutral. Devotees are not always neutral. Let's say that you know, you were really close to your friend and some friend cheated you and lied to you and hasn't seen you for a long time. And you may say, well, you know, let them contact me first. But you have another friend who comes in and sees, you know, I really wish they could get back together again. It's really paining me they're not together again. And they try to mend things between the two of you. So that's what the devotees do. The devotees go out into the world. And they say, hey, you know, why don't you come home? God's been missing you. So the devotee is, as Prabhupada says, more merciful than the Lord, in a sense, because they know the real purpose of it. And you might say, is it hard-heartedness on Krishna's part? No, it's respect. It's respect. He's respecting the free will of the living entity, and he's saying, I'm not going to force you. And so many times, I'm sure we've felt that maybe our parents were trying to manipulate us, and we had parents who you felt were trying to manipulate you. So Krishna doesn't manipulate, ever. He's not a manipulative parent. He says, it's entirely up to you, whatever you want to do. I'm not going to interfere with your free will. I'll give you the scriptures. I'll incarnate and dance the Ras Lila and attract you. But hey, you know, whatever you want to do, you can do. I'm not going to interfere with your free will at all. But the devotees will go out and say, please, please, come on. And Krishna's happy the devotees are doing it. It's okay, then he's not doing it. And sometimes when the devotees say please, the person has a little spark and says, yeah, I might like to do that. And then Krishna's mercy follows the mercy of the devotees. Therefore, it's explained that the giving of bhakti is causeless. Bhakti has no cause other than the bhakti in the heart of a devotee. And sometimes when we meet a devotee, whether directly or through a book or through tape or through something, tape, audio recording, I should have said record and then I would really date myself. Right? My first meeting of a devotee was through a record. However it is we first meet a devotee, if somehow it resonates with us, we go, yeah, I like that. I like that. I like that. That looks interesting. Something about that person. If we have some sort of even a small response, then that mercy of the devotee that flows to us, like it opens a channel for Krishna's mercy. All right. Now, I looked up, you know, we have what's called the Veda base, where we have everything that Prabhupada, well, not everything, but everything recorded that Prabhupada said. And if you look up Association of Devotees, it occurs 636 times in the Veda base. And here's a nice quote. This is from the third canto, 25:25, Teachings of Lord Kapiladev, where Prabhupada says, the process of advancing in Krishna consciousness and devotional service is described here. The first point is that one must seek the associations of persons who are Krishna conscious and who engage in devotional service. Without such association, one cannot make advancement. Simply by theoretical knowledge or study, one cannot make any appreciable advancement. One must give up the association of materialistic persons and seek the association of devotees, because without the association of devotees, one cannot understand the activities of the Lord. So we gave many reasons for that. Why one would want the association of devotees. Okay, now if we've at least preliminarily maybe thought about that I might want to associate with devotees, and I guess all of us have, or we wouldn't be sitting here. Okay, so I'll take that as a given. So how do you do that? And it's interesting that Rupa Goswami in the Upadeshamrita talks about two kinds of how to associate with the devotees. The first thing is he talks about the loving exchanges, six loving exchanges, which are really three loving exchanges, and one is a giving and taking of each, which makes six. So it's, what are they? Right? And confidences. So basically food, which in our case is Krishna prasadam, food, talking and confidences, and gifts. So giving and taking each. Some of us have a lot of trouble receiving. Right? Some people have a lot of trouble giving, and some people have a lot of trouble receiving. But both are parts of love. I give you something to eat, you give me something to eat. I reveal my mind to you, I listen to you. I give you some gift. Gift doesn't always mean a physical thing. I could give you gift of my time, I could give you gift of my energy, and I receive some gift in return. And Prabhupada explains that these ways of exchanging love are true everywhere, for everyone. You know, if you want to establish any relationship with anyone, then you're engaged in this give and take. So that's one of the how. But then Rupa Goswami goes on to explain that how you do this give and take depends on the level of advancement of the devotee. And again, level of advancement, we could talk about how clear your window is. But I wanted to look at level of advancement, and I was going to look at six different ways. And the first way that Rupa Goswami explains in the Nectar Devotion, anyone know how Rupa Goswami explains a Nectar Instruction? How you can understand the level of advancement of a devotee? He talks about by one's commitment. So that one who started to chant the Hare Krishna mantra or taken Harinam initiation is at the lowest level. One who's taken the Brahman initiation or Diksha and is worshipping the deities on the next level. And then he talks about the highest level. And at the highest level, he gives two qualifications. One is that they never stray from bhakti. In other words, they never stray from the truth. They're always in the truth. And the other is that they're completely free from the propensity or the inclination to criticize others. Remember we talked about that the basis for all association is never being envious. Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily that such a person is, it's not that they're just a naive fool, but they don't have any envy. So they might say, hey, that's not a good thing to do. It's not really good to walk off the edge of the roof of a building. That's not a really good thing to do. Or smoking is bad. They're not going to say, oh, whatever you want to do, you want to smoke, it's okay. But they don't have any fault-finding nature. So those are one way you can understand levels. And depending on the level, remember we talked about if you have to understand also your own level. So if someone's on a higher level with me, I'm pleased to see them, I serve them. If someone's on the same level, I become their friend. If someone's on a lower level, I help to elevate them. So one way of understanding the levels is, have I made a commitment to chanting? Have I taken diksha and I'm worshipping the deity? Or am I at the point that I never deviate from the truth and I have no envy in my heart? So one can understand according to those levels. Now, we could talk about this, by the way, for a couple weeks. So I'm just going to go through this real quickly. Another one is you could understand what level a person is on by how they deal with other living beings. Such an important thing. Because often we think that the level of spirituality someone has maybe is according to how much they follow the ritual strictly. But the definition is given how they deal with others. So, and this, by the way, this understanding of levels helps us to understand different religious systems in the world. And it also helps us to understand a lot of the horrible behavior that goes on in the world in the name of religion. So the lowest level is you only see God in the temple. Or really low, you only see God in my temple. My kind of temple. So God's only in the Lutheran church before 1680 rules. I remember my mother-in-law came to visit us and she had inadvertently bought the ticket during Easter time and I said, would you like me to take you to church? And she said, sure. I said, what church? She said, Lutheran. I looked it up and there was two main kinds. Which kind? And I think the one was like before 1680 and one was after 1680. Right? So people may say, God's only in the Lutheran church before 1680. And it gets so extreme, people kill each other over this, isn't it? The Sunni Muslims and the Shiite Muslims and the... Right, I was just reading an article about the... In the religious schools in Israel, that the Ashkenazi Jews are, they put up a brick wall in the school so that the Ashkenazi Jewish kids wouldn't be studying with the Sephardic Jewish kids. So that the very lowest level is you think God is only in my place of worship, and you treat all living entities very badly. You don't know how to deal with other living beings. And it's described that at this level, it's like, We sometimes make a fire sacrifice. We throw grains in the fire. So if you're functioning at this level, it's like you're throwing grains into ashes. And Jesus talked about this. He said, if you come to make an offering at the altar and you've had a quarrel with your brother, put down your offering, settle your quarrel with your brother, and then come and make your offering. So this is also one of the many reasons why we propound vegetarianism. We say, you've got to teach your brothers, you've got to treat your brothers nicely. You've got to, you know, love your neighbor. And love your neighbor doesn't just mean anyone who's a Catholic like me, or anyone who's an American like me, or anyone who's a human like me. But it means really to love all living entities, to be kind to all living entities. Now, a little higher level than that is you love God. You have actual love for God, not just something ritual. You have some feeling of affection for God. You make friendship with other spiritual practitioners, again, according to their level. You're kind to people who are innocent, and out of humility, not out of pride, you avoid atheists. You just think, I'm not able to help these people. I can't help them, and they can hurt me, so you avoid them. And at the highest level, you see that everyone is perfect. You see all living beings are perfect. So that's another way of determining at what level someone is functioning. Another explanation of levels is how deep a person's meditation on the truth is. Remember, we talked about undeviating from the truth. So at a lower level, okay, you think about Krishna sometimes, you think about the truth sometimes. As one devotee once said to Prabhupada, sometimes we fall into Maya. Maya means that which is not, something that's false. Prabhupada said, no, you're always in Maya. Sometimes you fall into Krishna. So in the very beginning level, you know, a day, a week, a month can go by and you haven't really thought about Krishna. Not the way we think about our child or our spouse or our work or what clothes we're going to wear tomorrow or those sort of things that absorb our, as Krishna says, 7-1, maya shakta mana partha, that our attachments, right? So I'm about to travel in a couple days. So my mind keeps going to, okay, what do I have to pack in my suitcase and where am I going? That's where my mind is flowing to that. So how often is our mind flowing to Krishna? What's Krishna doing? Okay, now it's about 8:30 at night. So right now, we were talking about he watches the entertainment. Right now, Krishna's watching the entertainment. Right now, he's there with the residents of Vrindavan, and there's the jugglers and the entertainers on the stage, and Nanda Maharaj, his father, is hoping that Krishna's happy, and everyone's kind of looking at Krishna. Did he like it? Did he like it? They're looking at what's on the stage. Like, Krishna, did he like it? So that's what Krishna's doing. So how often are we thinking about, what does Krishna look like? You know, when you're in love with somebody, you think about them, don't you? So what does he look like? What is he? What are his qualities? What's he doing now? What service can I do for him? So how deep is that meditation? In the beginning, it's occasional. Gradually, it starts becoming more and more frequent with affection. Pretty soon, one's meditation on Krishna becomes so deep that one loses awareness of the outside world. Just like I'm sure some of you are thinking about something else and you haven't heard a word I said for the last 5 minutes. Right? You lose your awareness of what's going on. We all do that in school sometimes, right? And the teacher called us and we...
Oh, I was thinking about the baseball game I'm going to pay for like this afternoon.
As you become so absorbed in Krishna, as in the yoga system is called pratyahara, you lose awareness. Something like what happens when we're sleeping, where we lose awareness of where we are. We're absorbed in our dream. And finally, that meditation becomes so, or like when people are watching a movie, that people watch a movie to try to become absorbed in the fantasy world. And then the final stage of meditation, you're not just fully absorbed, you enter into it. You revive who you are, you enter into it. You revive your position in Krishna's pastime. So another way one can understand levels of advancement is how deep one is in meditation. Another way is by how attached one is to chanting and the purity of one chanting. Is one chanting with offenses? Is one clearing the offenses? Or is one chanting in pure love where one realizes that Krishna is the same as his name? Another way is by how much faith one has, especially in the scriptures. Is one's faith really shaky? If someone just says something, you say, oh yeah, maybe it's not. Or do you really feel convinced, even though you can't necessarily convince others? Or are you really convinced and you can convince others? And one final caveat that I want to make about associating with devotees is I think those of us here in this room who've been trying to associate with other devotees for a very, very long time, years or decades, that we found that we can have unreasonable expectations. So I'd like to kind of put out this caution. When I first started practicing Krishna consciousness, I assumed that anyone who was also a member of the Krishna consciousness movement must be on the highest level. I assumed that everybody was at that level. And when I found out that really there's only a few people on that level, I became very disappointed by people's behavior and ended up feeling cheated. And it would have been awfully nice if at the beginning I'd had reasonable expectations. So I don't know if it's possible to have that at the beginning. And I've seen that most of us go through a period where we say, wait a minute, okay, I have to be discriminating. And I have to understand, in fact, the scriptures tell me to be discriminating according to these different systems. And I have to discriminate that not everybody is functioning on the highest level. You know, people are trying to clean their window, but if your window's covered with black paint, it may take a little while. You know, or like you ever burn something in a pot and been scrubbing it? You know, and you're scrubbing and scrubbing and scrubbing. It takes a while to get all the dirt off. And another thing that I've learned as far as really being in association with devotees for a long time is that we're told in the scripture that we can take shelter of the pure devotees and take shelter of the great devotees. And there's many, many songs like that. There's many, many statements of like that. But at the same time, there's no living entity, even a pure devotee, who's God. And that we should never take shelter of another devotee or another living being as if they were God. As if they, and God in the sense that they can meet all of our needs. The only person who can meet all of our needs is God. He's the only one. And Srila Prabhupada said that if the guru says, I'm your friend, he's a cheater. If he says, God is your friend, then he's a genuine guru. So the advanced devotees of the guru, they can be your best friend in the sense that they can introduce you to God and connect you to God, but they can't be God. They can't be God. There's no way that any living being can meet all of your emotional needs and all of your physical needs. It's just not possible. That our relationships, Srila Prabhupada said, with other living beings should be soul to soul via the super soul. So that's another cautionary note. I've seen many, many times people think, okay, I should take shelter of the devotees. Everything is from the devotees. All right, let me put this expectation on the devotees that's this big. And then when they can't meet it, I become very disappointed and angry, and I think I can't trust anybody anymore, and everyone's cheated me. And well, maybe I had a false idea. So that's not what it means. And the last thing that I wanted to look at here was the people in our lives who are important to us or who we have to work with in our family, where we go to school, where we work, who are not devotees. Who are not devotees maybe even by on any level. You know, we may see, of course, that people who aren't practicing Krishna consciousness may still be devotees on some level in another faith. But there's going to be people with whom we associate who we really don't have, you know, they're really not spiritually inclined. They're not really dedicating their life to God on any level. What do we do? How do we associate with such people? We can't just say, you know, again, when I joined the Hare Krishna movement, we took a very closed position. Something like, you know, the Amish or the Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox Jews, they close their society. They have very little interaction with the outside society. Now, we as followers of Srila Prabhupada actually can't do that. Why? Because he's told us to preach. And as soon as you're preaching, then you're interacting with the outside society. Have to be. You can't be cloistered. The Amish and the ultra-Orthodox Jews, they don't preach. In fact, they discourage people from taking up their faith and their way of life. They say, don't do it. You'll fail. You know, right? They say you have to be born an Amish. So we're not saying that. We're dealing with the greater society. We don't want to set up little... yeah, it's freezing. We don't want to set up little cloistered... Maybe some people do, but that's not our... That's not what we're advised, to set up little cloistered communities. And anyway, do we really want to have no dealings with anybody who's not a Hare Krishna devotee? I mean, maybe some people do, but most people don't. Again, in the beginning of the movement, many of us, you know, stopped seeing our parents and our brothers and sisters and all of our friends, and we did cut ourselves off, almost like the Amish going into a little cloistered community. And that may have some benefit for a very new movement starting in an alien culture. It may be helpful in the beginning, but it's certainly not a very good situation to be in long term. I mean, just like on a physical level, one thing the Amish have problems with is a lot of genetic diseases. You know, when you have a completely closed society, you end up with problems. It's not a natural way to be. And plus, we can't be that way as preachers. All right, well, how do we deal with people then who aren't devotees? And I came up with a few ideas. One is to see that everyone's dear to Krishna. Krishna loves everyone, not only every other human being, but every being. Krishna loves the cockroaches. In Hawaii, there's lots of cockroaches. I just came from there. I was in the shower one day, I saw a really big cockroach. You cannot get rid of the cockroaches in Hawaii.
Flying dates.
There's no question of not having any cockroaches in your house in Hawaii. And, you know, first I felt some repulsion for the body. And then I thought, but this living entity is also dear to Krishna. Now, I'll tell you, it's actually easier to think that way about cockroaches sometimes than other people. But everyone's dear to Krishna. And seeing that everyone is really ultimately dealing with Krishna, even if people aren't outwardly, explicitly, intentionally trying for spiritual life, everybody is trying to connect with Krishna. The serial killer is trying to connect with Krishna. Krishna says that he is also death. I mean, the most heinous, evil, cruel person is really looking for Krishna. They may be looking for Krishna in a way that's not going to bring them joy and peace and truth, but what they're looking for is Krishna. You see, everyone's looking for Krishna. You see that? How are they looking for Krishna? How are they really looking for Krishna? Yeah. All right, they're looking for Krishna in the wrong way. But they're looking for Krishna. No, they're driving west to go to New York. But they're trying to go to New York. And you might see that they're going to fall into the Pacific Ocean instead of getting to New York City. At least you know that they're looking for the right thing. And then with always having kindness and empathy and compassion. Without pride. Oh, I know the truth, and you don't. I'm better than you. So tempting, isn't it? And another way that I found really, really helped me is seeing that I don't own time. Krishna says he's time. I don't own time. And for myself, at least, and for those of us who've taken vows of initiation, I've already given myself to Krishna. I've already said, you know, Lord, I'm yours. You can do with me as you like. And if Krishna decides to put in my life somebody that's materialistic, or even someone who's spiritually inclined or who's difficult. That's the job he's given me to do. I really like something that C.S. Lewis says in his book, Screwtape Letters. He says, you know, once somebody has really said, okay, my Lord, you know, I belong to you. And let's say that God showed up in front of you. Let's say Krishna came in front of you and said, okay, you've said you're going to dedicate your life to me. All right, I want the next 24 hours, every minute of it. You go, oh, what's he going to ask me to do? You know, go preach in Saudi Arabia? And if then Krishna said to you, okay, I'd like you to spend an hour dealing with this really difficult materialistic person, you go, oh, is that it? That's all I have to do? So to see that the people that come into our life, the people that are part of our family, the people at our work, the people at our school, that we're with them for some reason. To learn something or to give something. Not to see them, oh, this is a non-devotee. This is a materialistic person. But okay, I'm here as Krishna's servant. I'm here as Krishna's instrument. What can I do? How can I deal with this person who's very dear to Krishna in a way that would please him? And to always remember when we're with people who are materialistically inclined, what is our goal? I think one of the main ways that we can avoid becoming unduly negatively influenced is to always fix ourselves on our goal. What's my goal in life? Where do I want to go to? All right. So, we talked about how the power of association, how association in general influences us. We talked about without the modes of material nature and our general principles of associating without envy. And we talked about the special benefits of associating with devotees over above just say people in the mode of goodness, then associating with devotees in the six loving exchanges according to their level of advancement and dealing with people in our life who are not devotees. So I hope I didn't talk for too long. And did that work out all right with my having my notes? That worked out pretty well. Then I figured I don't have to travel with a printer and print out. So, anything you guys wanted to discuss? Yes.
I have a question. You're saying like about avoiding atheists, but I mean, wouldn't it be better to like be with an atheist than be with a person who's like a religious fanatic who wants to like hurt people who aren't their religion?
Would it be better to be with a pleasant atheist than an angry, envious? They're really not that different. The person on the very lowest level of spirituality, they're like in spiritual nursery school, who thinks that spirituality means hating anybody who doesn't try to see spirituality the way that they do, is probably someone you should just respect in your mind. Just say, I have some respect that this person is starting on the spiritual path, but I wouldn't become intimate friends with them either. At least they've started on a spiritual path.
But also, knowing folks who are atheists and being able to maintain your Krishna consciousness in association with them is a great benefit.
If you can do that.
Yeah.
So the middle level of devotee feels that they're not able to do that. So that you have to judge for yourself. Can I do that or not? You know, what people can I be close friends with and still keep my own focus? I mean, it's kind of like if you're going to school and you want to get your degree and the people down the hall are having a party, is going down the hall going to mean that you fail your exam? That doesn't mean you never talk to them in the hallway, but do you really want to go hang out at their party? So that you have to have enough intelligence to say, what's my goal? What's my purpose? It's not, I don't hate those people. I'm not nasty to them. But if they say, would you like to come party? I say, well, you know, thanks, but I really have to study for an exam. I see it more like that avoiding the atheist is more like that. That you're fixed on your goal. This is not going to happen. But that depends on you. You know, it depends on, and one has to be very honest You know, to what extent can I deal with people who are in darkness and not become covered by darkness myself? Because when I'm to some extent seeing the light, I see the world very, 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 very differently. And my view of things is going to seem very odd to people in the dark. So, and if I'm with such people very much, then am I really going to be able to maintain who I am? Or am I going to start adjusting myself more and more so that they'll accept me? How strong am I? Am I strong enough to, you know, to have the light on in my own heart around people who are in darkness? And it's not easy. And I think it's a question of just honest humility to say how much I can do that. And it's not a question of being critical of the others, but just saying, you know, to what extent can I do that? Or do I start also becoming influenced? And that's, sometimes it's something even we can't see and we have to ask other people, you know, how am I doing? Because sometimes entering into darkness can be a very gradual thing. You know, it's just like there's stairs in this house, right? Mm-hmm. So you're at the top of the stairs. The bottom of the stairs is a long way down. But just one step isn't very far down. So if you're on the spiritual path and you know, you become very close with materialistic people and then you make a little compromise. Well, it's not a very big compromise. If you just look at where you were, maybe it was just a millimeter compromise. But now you're on a lower step. You're now a millimeter down. So then if you make another compromise, it's not very far from where you are. You know, each compromise takes you just very slowly away from where you were before. But at a certain point, you look up and you go, wow, how did I get here? You know, it's like, how do people become alcoholics lying in their vomit in the gutter? Nobody starts off like that. You know, you start off, oh, I'll just have one beer. And, you know, it wasn't so bad. You know, they told me it would rot my brain, and they said, I didn't do anything. I just had more fun at the party. You know, it's a slow path from the one beer at a party to the alcoholic lying in his vomit in the gutter. So you have to be careful. If you're going to deal with people who have the lights off, and who are especially people who are very much in the mode of ignorance, you've got to be very, very careful. And just like I remember many, many years ago, it must have been a long time ago, it was a black and white film, about doctors working in an area of contagious disease. And they were being really careful, you know, they had all this protective gear on. But there were so many people were sick and they were exhausted. And at one point, one of the nurses was just picked up a cup of water and drank it. And right after she did it, the other doctors looked, I still see that scene in my mind. The other doctors looked at her and said, that was the patient's water. And everybody just froze. So, you know, again, that's an individual. It's an individual thing that one has to look, but to be honest. If we want to come to truth, if we want to come to the light, then we have to be careful about becoming very, very intimately connected with people who don't want to turn on the light. It's hard. Sometimes it's very painful. And I think that most of us who've really made a commitment to spirituality have sometimes had to make really painful decisions as far as some of the people in our lives. Some real conflicts. And if you haven't, then you're very fortunate. But most of us have had to do that. Most of us sometimes have had to say, you know, I really can't be close friends with this person if I want to attain spirituality. It's not going to work. I think that's one of the, not for everybody, but for most people, that we end up having to make those kind of decisions. And they're certainly not easy decisions to make. And we see that even at the very highest level of devotees of the Lord, the gopis, the milkmaids of Vrindavan, they're making those decisions. They're running to Krishna in the middle of the night. although their family members are saying, don't go. Don't go to Krishna. And they just run. They're even cooking. And they just run. So that's... Sometimes that's definitely one of the most difficult decisions. And many... As I travel the world, one question that comes up over and over and over again is how do I keep all of my friendships and all of my relationships that I have right now and still become a devotee of Krishna? And I don't always say it, but I know you may not necessarily be able to. There may be maybe some relationships that you're going to say, you know, this is, I'm going to have to choose. I think we'd all rather it wasn't that way. That's what I've seen. Is that all right?
Sure.
I think at some point I think we should see that the only relationship we want is with Krishna. So all the other relationships then they don't become important to keep anymore.
That may be a choice. You know, we're all individuals. And I would rather discuss principles and let you decide how to apply those principles. There was a time in my life when I didn't do that. And I don't want to do that anymore. Yeah, I'm really trying to get away from that. I'm not 100% successful at it, but I'm really trying to get away from that. I'd rather tell you principles and you decide how you want to apply them. And my guess is that you'll apply the principles differently at different points in your life and with different people and in different situations. And I no longer believe that there's one right way of doing this. I think it depends on who you are. One of the aspects of our philosophy is that we're all unique individuals eternally. Mm-hmm. If you want to know something about God, just by logic and reason, one of the things you're going to end up with is that he must really like individuality. Really like individuality. We don't even have two snowflakes that's the same. There's no two fingerprints as those two little boys. You know, they're not the same. They don't have exactly the same DNA, even though they're identical twins. They don't have the same personality and have the same fingerprint.
I was at a lecture in New Vrindavan. It's a Vaishnavi retreat. Now I cannot remember what devotee gave the lecture. But he said something that I thought was really amazing. He said that actually each of us has been, you know, created by Krishna for a very,
specific,
every single person
has
a specific relationship with him.
That's right.
Specific qualities that are really
only ours. Only ours. Yes.
That is incredible.
Yes. That's right. And because Krishna is complete and he's Atmarama and Aptakama, Krishna can create for himself whatever our relationship is without us. He doesn't need us in the sense that I need. Actually, I don't even need either. It's an illusion that I need. But he'd prefer to have that relationship with us. The story that really shows this is that of Lord Brahma stealing the boys and calves. That Lord Brahma steals all of Krishna's cowherd boyfriends and puts them into a deep slumber. And then Krishna expands his own self to become again all these boys. And they all look exactly, not only look like, act like. Not only act like, they have the same preferences. Sometimes people think that if you're advanced in spiritual life, you shouldn't have any personal preferences. I've heard so many people say, oh, if you have any personal preferences, that's illusion. But they all have personal preferences. They all have their favorite color and their favorite food and their favorite this and their favorite that. And it all looked like the original boys, but they weren't. They were all expansions of Krishna. And then Brahma comes back and he sees all of these cowherd boys. And it's explained by the commentaries that he goes to the cave where the original boys were sleeping, and then he goes back and sees these boys, and he keeps going back and forth, and he thinks maybe Krishna's just switching them really fast. You know, and then he figures, no, that's not... And he's completely bewildered. Now, why is he so bewildered? He can't understand it. And he's the most intelligent being in the whole universe. Why couldn't he understand it? What was the problem? Why couldn't he understand? Here's just an identical set of boys. He wasn't thinking they were Krishna. So therefore he thought they were also living entities. He thought the boys that he saw now were living beings, living individual souls, and the boys he captured were individual souls. And why was that so bewildering to him?
They were the same.
Because they were the same, and there can only be one. You can never have, there can never be, there never will be, never was. That's not for me, right?
Yes.
That's for like Kumbhakarna or Bhima or maybe my son could eat this plate. There's only one being like us. And we have a very particular service for Krishna. Just like it's explained, and I'll end with this, just like it's explained that there's five different relationships you can have with Krishna. Neutrality, as a servant, as a beloved, as a parent, as a friend. And then if you read Rupa Goswami, he gives subcategories. You know, like a beloved of Krishna, you can be Krishna's wife or Krishna's girlfriend. Then the subcategories of those. You can be more submissive or you can be more fiery. And then the subcategories, they go on to about four or five levels of subcategory. But actually, you could keep going and keep going, and each of us is in our own particular category. And even in this world where we're not exhibiting our eternal personality, we're like actors on a stage who've taken on the persona and the character of someone who's not ourselves. Still, we even have individuality manifest in this body. And therefore, you know, there's certain things you could say that everybody should do. But that's a very short list. And even that list, people are going to do it a little differently. Prabhupada says, nectar devotion, one should perform devotional service according to one's taste. So, I hope that's okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
All right, Krishna.